Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. When China opened its doors to international adoption in 1991, 61 Chinese babies, mainly girls, were immediately adopted by Americans. Last year, nearly 8,000 children made the long journey from China to adoption in America, by far the highest number from any single country abroad. These children, more than 95% of them girls, have become well-loved members of many American families and a well-known part of many American communities. Now, the oldest are reaching their late teens and just beginning to know themselves and their stories as young adults. This hour on Point, the great wave of babies adopted from China just beginning to come of age and looking at their families and their lives in America. You can join the conversation. Are you, is your family part of the wave? And how do you read the story of more than 50,000 adopted Chinese babies soon to come of age in America? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We turn first today to China and to Peter Goodman. He is Shanghai Bureau Chief for The Washington Post. He's been following the ongoing story of adoption from China. He joins us from Shanghai. Peter, thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks very much for having me.
Peter, remind us of the origins of this great movement in Chinese babies to the world and to the United States. Take us back to the policy and the opening of doors that first produced it.
Well, the opening of doors that first produced, you're essentially talking about bringing together two very large groups of people who need one another. You have a lot of children in China, largely girls, who are routinely abandoned in part because of the one-child policy, which restricts most families in China to just one baby. And boys are still, at least in traditional households, very, very important. And if you have a girl, some families can't afford to pay the fines that they'd have to pay to have a second child will tragically abandon their girls. That's been happening for years and years in China. Meanwhile, you have families around the world. Most of the families so far are in America, but increasingly they're in Europe and Canada, and they very much want these baby girls. And so these two groups have come together, and there's been a policy that's been created that dates back to the early 90s in China, where this one central authority, the China Center for Adoption Affairs, matches children with families that want the children through adoption agencies in other countries.
And Peter, the abandonment that you talk about, is that institutionalized? Do all Chinese know what to do if they have a daughter that they don't think they can keep, or is it? How does it actually happen?
In a sense, it's institutionalized. I mean, in villages, there are usually, in some cases, there are women, usually older women, who will take children. In other cases, children are bundled up and they're left in public places, usually early in the morning, where somebody will come along and find them and hand them over to the police, and the police will then make a report and take them to the local social welfare institutes, as the orphanages are known. And what happens to them after that depends on the age of the child and whether they've got medical problems, whether they're suitable for foreign adoption.
And Peter, is China comfortable with this whole process? It's growing in wealth every year. Is this going to go on and on? The one-child family, does that look a policy? Does it look permanent? Does an outflow of Chinese babies look like a permanent feature of Chinese life?
Well, you certainly don't hear much talk about liberalizing one child, the one-child policy. I mean, this is country of more than 1.3 billion people. There are parts of the country that are just enormously crowded, very, very dense populations living on not enough land in places to sustain people in terms of agricultural output. So that's you don't hear talk of a liberalization. There are more and more people who are now comfortable enough to take on children, and actually, I mean, one of the really unintended and somewhat tragic ironies of the foreign adoption program is that under the regulations, the way foreign adoptions work in China, foreign families will pay $3,000 to the orphanages that give up the children, and that money compensates the orphanage for taking care of the children and allows orphanage directors to put those funds to use to improve the facility. utilities, to deliver health care, to buy clothing and food and so on. And orphanage directors, in some cases corrupt and in some cases not corrupt, well-intentioned and looking for funds to put to good use for the care of the kids they've got, would much rather deliver kids into foreign families and collect the $3,000 than put them out for adoption to local families. So they've been putting up all sorts of barriers. I've heard this again and again from people in orphanages, from Chinese families, that it's just very difficult now for Chinese families to adopt if they're dealing with orphanages that are eligible to participate in the foreign adoption program. There is
that is Chinese families who cannot or would not cannot afford, let's say, to pay that kind of $3,000 fee to adopt a child. That's a huge amount in China.
Yeah, that's right. That's just and for most people, that's just an unthinkable amount of money.
You had an article earlier this month, Peter, headlined "Stealing Babies for Adoption." This seems to be the great exception rather than the rule. But what's going on there?
Well, there has been some trafficking going on that's involved the foreign adoption program, and it's difficult to say to what degree trafficking has penetrated the foreign adoption program. But there has been a case prosecuted very recently in Hunan province in southern China, in which defense attorneys tell us roughly 1,000 children were trafficked, were brought from neighboring Guangdong province, which is a largely industrialized, at least along the coast, a province where a lot of migrant workers go and congregate. And these traffickers have in some cases preyed on migrant workers, assuming that the migrant workers would be less willing to go to the police and complain and kick up a fuss. And in some cases, they've actually pried children out of the arms of these migrants, and they've taken them off to Hunan. In other cases, in probably the large majority of cases, according to the defense attorneys, the traffickers have gotten hold of kids who've been abandoned, and then they've taken them up to Hunan, and they've sold them to orphanage directors, corrupt orphanage directors, at six orphanages in one particular city.
So these would get into the flow of children who are moving out into the world, potentially to America.
Yeah, I mean, not just potentially. I mean, according to a source I talked to who was involved in the prosecution, some of these kids, and it's unclear how many, have landed in America.
But the numbers I'm looking at in your story here are quite small compared to the overall volume of children moving.
Well, we know, I mean, the prosecutor presented evidence on 78 cases. I mean, the prosecutor selected a certain number of cases, but the defense attorneys themselves and the mother of one of the defendants I spoke to said, we're talking about 1,000 kids from 2001 till this ring was shut down late in 2005. That's 1,000 kids of roughly 40,000 kids who landed in the foreign adoption pool during that period. I mean, that's 2.5%, and that's the one ring that we actually know about in China.
Peter, let me ask you just a last question for you. China's a big, proud country. Is there any conversation there about why are Chinese children going abroad, or is this look like, you know, a good fit of need and longing on each side?
Well, that's a good question. There is no question that the foreign adoption program has done an awful lot of good for kids who've gotten themselves good homes in the U.S. and other countries who wouldn't have had those homes. That's something that's definitely appreciated at the central government level in China and appreciated by orphanage directors. There's no question that some of this money has landed in the hands of honest and decent people at orphanages in China who've put it to good use. There's also now no question that the system is somewhat vulnerable to abuse and has to be looked at. And there's always been a debate in China. As you say, it is a proud and sometimes nationalistic country. There are people who see it as unseemly that these kids are being taken off to other countries. Now, that's generally been a minority view within the higher reaches of the government. But that's always a potential issue, and now that there's a problem that's emerged, undoubtedly there's that debate's going on.
Peter Goodman, Shanghai Bureau Chief for The Washington Post. Peter, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
I want to turn now to Washington and Lynette Clementson. She's correspondent for The New York Times based in D.C. She's author of the recent New York Times article, Adopted in China, Seeking Identity in America. Lynette, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
So you looked out into the world and found the children, girls, now teenagers, who are getting, some of them, into their late teens since their adoption in the very early 90s. What kind of issues are coming up?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, there are a small group now, a couple of hundred, who are between the ages of 13 and 17 who were adopted right in the early years of this when the law was changing in 1991. And though I approach the story from the United States, my interest in it is from the other side because I first became introduced to this growing wave of girls while I was a correspondent for Newsweek in Hong Kong.
Mm-hmm.
And my husband and I had gone to Guangzhou for the weekend, and we stayed at the White Swan Hotel.
Where many families do on their way out with adopted children?
That's right, and we had no idea at the time that this hotel and the town surrounding the hotel was a major transit point. And we, I think, were the only couple in the hotel without a baby and without the baby that we were adopting and taking back to the United States. And so I have been interested since that time to be able to talk to those girls when they got to an age where they could voice for themselves their experience of having been adopted in the United States. And so I have been waiting for a time for them to reach their teen years where they can begin to articulate their experiences on their own. And what's really interesting to me is that there is no central experience. It is diverse as it is for any American teenager seeking to find their identity. But with this added complex, really nuanced layer of having been adopted from a country where the policies have encouraged the abandonment of children, predominantly girls.
Where they're not just any American teenager. At the end of the day, they've got a special story. Lynette, stick with us. We want to hear it. What you're writing, more than 55,000 Chinese children, almost all girls adopted by Americans since the early 90s, more than 7,900 from China just last year. Listeners, what do you think? Are you part of the wave? Have you? Are you adopted from China? And how's it going? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Is there strength in numbers in this story? Is there something special going on here? Or just American life? 800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the great wave of babies adopted from China just beginning to come of age and looking at their families and lives in America. You can join the conversation. Are you part of the wave? Have you? Are you adopted from China? Have you felt the wave in your community? Is it adding something new to the fabric of your town? And families with Chinese-born children, what's great? What's glorious? What's difficult in the story you are now part of? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. We've been joined by Lynette Clementson, a reporter for the New York Times, who wrote about these mainly girls, now some of them coming into their teen years and seeking their identity in America, her headline. We're joined now as well from Minneapolis, Minnesota, by Dana Johnson. He's director of the International Adoption Clinic at the University of Minnesota. Dana Johnson, thanks so much for joining us.
It's a delight, Tom.
And we're joined from New York City by Nancy Kim Parsons. She's an adult Korean adoptee, now 33 years old, raised in Minneapolis, working on a documentary film on Chinese adoption. Nancy Kim Parsons, thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Dana Johnson, first to you, if I may, just give us some context here for these numbers out of China. More than 55,000 children adopted since 1991, 7,900 plus last year. How does this fit in the long story of American adoption from abroad? Is this the biggest group ever, just one more group? How's it look?
Well, it certainly is a very large group. If you look back through the history of international adoption and go back to when it really started, which was after World War II, certainly the Korean kids, because they've been coming since the mid-50s, constitute a larger group of children. But probably the Chinese kids represent the largest influx over a defined period of time of any group that we've seen. And I think the Chinese children are unique, as has been pointed out by the speakers previously, that 95% of them are girls.
I'm looking at the numbers you've provided us here. Last year, 7,906 from China, 4,600 some from Russia, Guatemala 3,700, Korea 1,600, the Ukraine 800 plus, Kazakhstan 750, Ethiopia 440. But China, head and shoulders above those other numbers. Nancy Kim Parsons, you look on this not as someone from China, but as someone who came as a girl from Korea. You're kind of ahead of the wave of Chinese girls who will soon be coming of age. What's on your mind when you look at their experience? What can they anticipate?
Well, I think that the thing that inspired us to work on this documentary, and I do want to just make it clear that this is the first film that we are doing, and I am by no means trying to claim that I'm a filmmaker and an experienced filmmaker. I don't want people to have unrealistic expectations from me.
Don't start apologizing before it comes out. It'll be great.
It will, but I just needed to say that.
Yeah.
I think the thing that we are really interested in, the person that I'm working with this and co-producing with, Barb Lee, we are interested in the racial identity and how these girls figure out and come to terms with who they are coming into their teens and adult years, and whether that's going to be different or how it's going to be different than it was for the Korean adoptees.
How was it for you growing up as a Korean adoptee when you hit the teenage years and I don't know, was that when you began to think more about these things? And how was it?
Well, it was pretty crappy. It was a tough experience. I grew up in Minneapolis, Minnesota, and in pretty much a all Caucasian community. Hmm. And I think it's tough for kids to grow up and to be different. And when you have adoption issues and then you layer on the racial aspect of it, it really can, it brings in a lot of complex challenges and issues. And I had a hard time figuring out who I was. I wanted to be like everybody else. And I think that when kids are young, that is really what they want to be. They want to just fit in and be like everybody else. And when you're Asian and you're with Caucasian kids, you kind of don't fit in. So, you know, that's just, you stick out like a sore thumb. But
maybe in some communities, and maybe more then than now, I mean, the numbers from China are big enough. Lynette Clementson, did you find the girls that you talked to having that same attitude, or do they feel, you know, sort of part of a group that they can identify with?
I think it really, in the people that I talked to, depended on the communities in which they were raised. I mean, I talked to one family where the girls were raised in Virginia and West Virginia and had mm-hmm. very little contact with other Asians and other adoptees. By contrast, a family that I talked to in New York, there are two Chinese adopted daughters in that family, and they had a lot of contact with other Asian Americans and a lot of contact with other adoptees, and so their experiences are quite different. So I think it has to do a lot with where the children are raised.
I want to turn to our listeners. We've got lots who want to join this conversation. Let's go first to Montreal, Canada, and Tammy. Hi, Tammy. You're on the air.
Hi, good morning.
Thanks for calling. What do you know, Tammy?
What do I know?
Yeah.
Well, I am an adoptee. I'm 29.
Mm-hmm.
And, my experience has been, I grew up in a very isolated community here in Canada. And when I moved up to Montreal, then I could kind of I could go and look for people who were from the same country where I was born.
Were you adopted from China, Tammy?
Yes, I was. I was actually adopted from Macau, which mm-hmm. at the time was a Portuguese colony.
Just across the river mouth from Hong Kong there. And what about the issue Nancy Kim Parson raises of racial identity? Has that been a big issue for you or not?
It became so when I moved up here, because a lot of people asked me what were my origins, what were my roots, and they're basically Francophone and Anglophone roots, Canadian actually.
Mm-hmm.
So I've always had a love-hate relationship with China. It's been a loving relationship because it is an amazing civilization.
No kidding.
But it's always it's kind of been a hate relationship because it's a country where I felt rejected from. So, mm-hmm. yeah, it's very odd. It's very odd.
Lynette Clementson, respond to that. That dealing with the issue, the love-hate issue that Tammy described, did you hear that from the girls you spoke with?
Absolutely. I think even though they're really just on the in the beginning stages of this, I think and what some of the older people that I talked to, like Nancy Kim and another woman, Holly McGinnis, who I mentioned in the story, mm-hmm. that really this process starts to crystallize once the children leave their family's house and go to college, become adults. But even in the teenage girls, you know, all of the girls that I had talked to had been to visit China with their families. And it was interesting to hear them talk about feeling the most isolated sometimes when they were in China, because all of a sudden, you know, they knew they were Chinese, but they didn't feel very Chinese in China. They looked like everyone else to mm-hmm. a certain extent, mm-hmm. but in other ways, everything about them screamed that they were American. And people looked at their faces from afar, expected them to be able to speak Chinese, but they didn't speak Chinese, even if their parents had tried to put them in language classes. And so it was a, you know, I think it was a real struggle. And when I asked the girls, did they want to go back to China on their own at some point and further explore their country and the link to that country, I think they had really mixed feelings about it and even a degree of fear about going back to China.
Nancy Kim Parsons, can you relate to that? Can you understand that response?
I can relate to that. When I was 20, I went back to Korea for the first time and only time up to this point in my life. And I think that there are several different stages in sort of the identity process for adoptees. I think that there, and depending upon where you grow up, absolutely makes a difference. And I think for me, I wanted to be like everybody else, and so I just kind of blended in, and I really denied that I looked the way that I do. So there's this mirror, this thing that we call looking back in the mirror, and, you know, you feel a certain way. You're surrounded by people that look like your family, like, and those are your family and your friends, and so you just start to feel like you're like them, but then all of a sudden you look in the mirror, and I used to look in the mirror and just be shocked that I look the way that I did because of how I grew up and who I was surrounded by. And so that was the beginning part of my teen years. And then when I sort of got into college, you don't have your parents, you don't have your family to sort of be your cushion. Mm-hmm. You don't have the luxury of white privilege when you're on your own. I had it when I was with my parents. I had it when I was with my family or other family members and friends. But once I was on my own, because I look the way that I look, people assumed certain things about me. And I didn't understand those assumptions because I had no connections to them. So then I kind of went into this process of trying to discover that part of myself and really was, you know, trying to embrace the mm-hmm. Korean part of me. And you realize that when you go back to Korea, you're not accepted as being Korean. You're not one of them. So you kind of are left in this place of, okay, well, I'm not American to some people because I look the certain way, look the way that I do, and I'm not Korean. So where do I belong? Where do I fit in?
And yet America is so diverse these days, and of course Canada the same. Tammy, how about for you, the bottom line? You're 28, 29 now. When you look at your experience, do you add it up? Do you come to a conclusion about what, you know, has this been good, bad, or mixed for you?
I think it's been a very good experience because on one part, it just forces you to figure out who you are as a person and not only as, you know, a visible minority or as, you know, it makes you discover who you are, especially for these Chinese adoptees, who you are as a woman. So, yeah, and I've looked more into women's issues and you know, just... Yeah, it's been a weird experience, but on the whole, I've been really happy with it.
We're so glad to hear that, and we wish you the best of luck there, Tammy. Thank you for calling in. Lynette Clemmonson, I know we've got to let you go, but you point out one interesting thing here, that the families adopting from China tend to be white and upper middle class, I guess even more than the average adopting family.
I think up to this point, certainly that's been true. Now, there are some places in San Francisco, as I understand it, about a third of the families are Asian American.
Mm-hmm.
But But certainly up to now, these families have overwhelmingly been white and upper middle class. And so one of the things that I think is going to be interesting as these girls move into adulthood is how their identities, their changing identities, are shaping the Asian American experience. Because, of course, they're Asian American, but they're coming from a really different background.
That is not from Asian American families, exactly. They're
right.
Asian American in a different sense.
That's right. And so it'll be, I'm interested always in talking to people like Nancy about this, because it was interesting to talk to her and to Holly about what it's like when you apply for a job and you do an interview over the phone and you introduce yourself as Nancy Parsons or Holly McGinnis or mm-hmm. Mackenzie Forbes or whoever, mm-hmm. and then you show up and people are expecting one person, and you walk in the door as an Asian American, and there's a reaction that is palpable, and how that changes how you approach being a part of American society, how you approach activism and your role as an Asian American, and I think it's going to produce some interesting things.
Maybe palpable, but also maybe more and more unsurprising as these girls move into young adulthood. Lynette Clementson, I want to thank you so much for your reporting, and thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Lynette Clementson with the New York Times. Joining us now from Warren, New Jersey, is Carrie Kitsey. She's author of I Don't Have Your Eyes. She's founder of EMK Press, which publishes books on adoption. She has adopted two Chinese children, ages 7 and 5 now, first went to China in 1999. Carrie, thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Tom. Thanks for having me.
I Don't Have Your Eyes is the title. It says a lot right there. What's your experience been, Carrie?
Well, my oldest daughter has dealt with identity formation for a long time, and that book was written for her to come to terms with the fact that she looks different from her parents.
So she didn't have to wait to be a teenager. She's only 7 now. It's there early. How does it show up, and how does it work?
Well, for us to go out as a family and present ourselves, people know our story without us telling it to them. And for my oldest daughter, that's a very difficult thing, because she would like to be able to keep pieces of her life private.
It is, being sort of anonymously adopted, but now everybody knows the pattern here, you're saying.
That's right. And we get a lot of looks and stares. People remember us because we're a transracial family. And for her, it's been particularly difficult.
But at this point, are the looks of, oh my gosh, that's strange? I mean, in many degrees, it seems to become so ordinary.
Well, it depends. You get some of both. You get some of people who can't understand how you could be parenting a child of a different race. And you get people who are interested in finding out about adoption. So you get the gamut. And grandparents and all that kind of stuff.
Dana Johnson, you've looked at families who have adopted from many different countries. Does this sound like the typical story of adopting from abroad, or is there something unique here?
No, this is very typical, because most of the adoptions that occur now internationally are transracial adoptions. The only children that tend to look like the Caucasian families who are adopting are the children coming from Western Russia. We looked at a large group of international adoptive families in Minnesota who had come between 1990 and 1998, and we asked them if they had experienced intrusive comments about adoption and about race. And as you would expect, the families who had children who were adopted transracially had a more negative experience. But even then, they very, very infrequently received intrusive comments about adoption or about race from their own family members or teachers or coworkers or their own friends. The individuals who did make those intrusive comments tended to be strangers, neighbors, and their child's peers. Mm-hmm. So it's common, but it's not a big problem for the families per se. And I think that as we have seen the Korean adoptees get older, mm-hmm. we realize that the experience for the parents has been different than the experience for the children.
In what respect, Dana?
Well, I think the kids are dealing much more with the racial issue over a longer period of time.
Nancy, we just got half a minute before the break. It sounds like you can attest to that.
I can. absolutely. I think that when parents are adopting internationally, and, you know, we all tend to do this naturally, we look at things from our perspective, and they do. They look at it from the perspective of a Caucasian person who probably does have the, who does have the best intentions and is educated and liberal and progressive and thinks, you know what, I don't really care if I'm raising a child from another race and culture. But for the child, they do care because they end up getting the racial names and the derogatory comments and the feeling of not belonging and being accepted to a much stronger degree than the parents.
We've got to take a short break here. We'll be right back. We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Support for On Point comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, and by Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at Bicon.com, Bicon.com.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the great wave of babies adopted from China, now just beginning to come of age and looking at their families and lives in America. You can join the conversation. How do these girls look at their coming to America, at their beginning in China? What will the Amy Tan of this generation of American girls have to say? And families with Chinese-born adopted children, what's great, what's glorious, what's difficult in the story you're now part of? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. We've been joined from Minneapolis by Dana Johnson, director of the International Adoption Clinic at the University of Minnesota there. From Warren, New Jersey, by Carrie Kitsey, mother of two adopted Chinese girls. Carrie, is that right, both?
That's correct, yes.
And by Nancy Kim Parsons, an adult Korean adoptee, now 33, raised in Minneapolis, working on a documentary about Chinese adoption. Amy's calling from Lexington, Massachusetts. Hi, Amy, you're on the air.
Hi. I'm so grateful for this conversation. It's one that I've been hoping to have for almost a decade now.
That's a long time to wait. What's your story, Amy?
I'm the older sister of a Korean adoptee who came to this country at the age of six in 1981. She's probably about the same age as Miss Parsons now, and it's a very difficult fit.
Now, let me understand. So you're an American-born girl. Mm-hmm. Your sister was born in Korea and adopted there into your American family.
I have one other biological sister.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And when I was about 19 and my sister was 14, my parents just couldn't bear not to have any more children in the house. And we all sat down as a family and decided that this seemed like an amazing idea, and we all wanted to do it desperately. And
lots of siblings can have very difficult relations. What do you think is, you say it's a difficult fit. What do you mean?
In terms of what Ms. Parsons was talking about, in terms of not feeling like one belongs anywhere. My sister, again, we lived in a very homogenous community, and it was a time when people thought my parents were crazy for doing this. And she was the only Korean adoptee in a community of about 30,000 people. So she looked different from everyone in the family. She looked different from everyone in her community. And I think it was always a source of humiliation to her. And I think Ms. Parson used the phrase about looking in the mirror. And she was so beautiful. And she just never saw herself that way. She always saw herself as the misfit.
Do you think it changed since then, Amy? I mean, there are so many Asian Americans among us now and so many adoptees from China. Do you think that sense of peculiarity is going to be so strong?
Well, what's great about what's happening is that there are so many families. Living in Lexington, it's, you know, every fourth family you meet has an Asian adoptee, and there's an incredible source of support now, which didn't exist when my parents did this. They were real pioneers. The sad thing is, and I believe the woman who left the panel talked about, in addition to the trials of adolescence and, you know, the issues within a family, and we grew up in a very loving family, her identity became a huge source of pain to her, and she basically sat down with my parents and told them they ruined her life, and she hated them, and basically estranged herself from the family.
Was that a teenage response or an adult response?
She's 32 now.
Wow. Let me put this to our panel. Carrie Kitsey, first to you. In your experience with much younger girls adopted from China, do you still feel that sense of them being excluded? Racial epithets, Nancy Kim Parsons says, the sense of racial of standing out racially, or has it become enough more common that that's simply not a big issue?
Well, I think for any family, if you work to make connections for your children, that they can find faces that look like theirs and have experiences that share theirs, I think that gives a great sense of empowerment to our children. My daughters, for example, have a group of kids that they've known basically since they've come home, that we started out as a play group together, mm-hmm. and we've got kids who are from 8 to 12, and we get together about once a month.
And are these children also adopted
They're
from China?
They're all adopted. They're all adopted from China. They're all girls, and they've got a connection that is just palpable, mm. and they are very good friends because they don't have to explain who they are, how mm-hmm. they came to a family. Mm-hmm. They've got someone that looks like them and has the same past as they have.
That's a very strong bond. Nancy, what about Amy's story? I mean, you're 33 now. Amy's sister's 31. Do you think maybe the society and its expectations have changed in a way that's going to make it a lot easier for this new generation of girls?
I think things are changing. I think it really depends on where these kids are growing up in those formative years and how much contact that they do have with diverse people and groups of people and minorities. I think that there are lots of adopted children that are growing up, let's just say, in the Midwest, that are growing up in smaller communities that don't have a lot of contact and are living in isolation. And I will say that that is going on, and I think that that is a recipe for some problems with racial identity. Now, the families that I have interviewed, that I have been blessed to be able to interview mm-hmm. and really have a lot of contact on the East Coast in the cities, it is different. I think one thing that also makes a difference is that, for instance, there are lots of these girls are growing up either as single children or with other Chinese adopted kids. And mm-hmm. I think that might make a difference in terms of having somebody else like yourself. Now, with the woman from who was just speaking about her sister, mm-hmm. I felt exactly the way that she did at times, too, because I was the only one that was different. And I think that that makes a difference. And I also wanted to just comment on the fact that, you know, one of the things that we are trying to also address and give voice to in this film of ours is to the siblings, because it definitely has an impact on them as well.
To siblings who may not be Chinese-born.
Right, mm-hmm. right. But they are affected by... They are definitely affected by this process in a lot of ways. And I'm sure that it's very upsetting to know that you have a sibling that is estranged from your family as we speak, that's a painful, a source of pain for her.
But surely you're not saying it has to be that way, Nancy.
No, it doesn't always have to be that way. And, you know, one thing that we really have to keep in mind is there are lots of things that are going to contribute to a child having a healthy sense of racial identity mm-hmm. and a child not having a healthy sense of racial identity. You know, growing up in isolation is definitely not going to add to a recipe of a healthy sense of racial identity. However, these kids that are growing up in cities and that are having connections to other kids that are from China, I think that definitely has to be a positive thing and be making a difference. Mm.
Amy, thanks very much for your call. Let's take a call from Needham, Massachusetts. Rose is calling, and I think this may be, is this Rose Lewis?
Yes, it is.
Author of I Love You Like, is it Baby Cakes?
Crazy Cakes.
Crazy Cakes, that's right. I know that book. Rose, you've adopted from China. What are you hearing in this conversation?
Well, I think what's important, and I think what people have brought up, is that, in particular with the Chinese girls, they have, in many cases, many friends who are Chinese. They're not there alone. And I think, while we're all wondering what will happen in the Chinese years, I think that what they've been doing is learning about their adoption as they get older, as it's age appropriate. And I think at the same time, a lot of parents are hopefully educating and not alienating, those outside of the family, those in the schools, relatives, friends. My daughter is in a school system that, you know, embraces her, but still there are teachers who have things to learn, and I do stick with that educate, don't alienate, because you can alienate people by trying to teach them about adoption and about what your child may be going through.
Rose, let me ask you. You wrote I Love You Like Crazy Cakes, a very popular book about exactly this, about a girl adopted from China. But as a very young girl, as your daughter grows up, what are you telling her about China and the racial identity issue that Nancy Kim Parsons raises?
Well, I think what I'm trying to do is be very honest with her as it's appropriate. She asked a lot of questions. She had an experience as a very young girl when she was in first grade with a teacher being pregnant, and that brought up a lot of questions. To the, you know, the most heartbreaking, why didn't anybody want me? Why did my mother leave me? But I had written the book, and I wrote the book, and it is kind of a, you know, Pollyanna view of things, mm-hmm. but I think it was done so that people could start a discussion about adoption. Many, many parents come up to me or grandparents or friends and say, boy, it's a great way to introduce children, adopted or not, or their friends, to adoption.
Rose, we love the book, and we wish you luck in your own family there going forward, and we're grateful to you for calling. Rose Lewis wrote, I Love You Like Crazy Cakes. It's a sweet one, Rose. Thanks for calling in.
Thank you.
Our time is almost up here. Nancy, you've been through this yourself. We've got half a minute. What's your advice to families and communities about how they can best embrace and hold up these girls?
Well, I think one of the most important things that we actually, you know, that parents really need to address and adoption professionals and agencies, et cetera, is that it's not just the adoption issues that are really difficult. We're dealing with race, and that's a very uncomfortable and a very hot topic that in this society that we talk around it, we talk above it, but we really don't talk about it, and we are starting to. But that is what I would say is that families really need to address race, what their whiteness, what being white, what their experience is being white and how their children not being white, what that experience is going to be, and their experience in terms of how that's going to and could create barriers in understanding in the family.
So don't duck it. Take it head on. And I'm afraid with that, we're out of time. Nancy Kim Parsons, it's wonderful to have you. Good luck with the film. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Carrie Kitsey, mother of two from China and author of I Don't Have Your Eyes. Carrie, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
And Dana Johnson, director of the International Adoption Clinic at the University of Minnesota. Mr. Johnson, thanks so much for being on.
Thanks so much, Tom.
In a moment, an adoption story for the Olympic record books. This is On Point. American Mogul's skiing sensation, Toby Dawson, lived in a South Korean orphanage until he was adopted as a toddler by a Colorado family. Last month at the Winter Olympics in Turin, Italy, with his proud adopted parents cheering him on, Awesome Dawson won a surprise bronze medal in freestyle moguls. Watching it all with his personal interest was Sports Illustrated magazine senior writer Rick Riley. You see, his daughter, Ray, was also adopted from South Korea. In his column, Life of Riley, he wrote that Toby Dawson's victory was about much more than a race down a mountain. We asked Rick Riley to read his essay for us.
Olympic medals can lead to riches, fame, or a new girlfriend. They can lead to a job, a life, or an appearance on the Today Show. But Toby Dawson hopes his leads to something completely different, his birth parents. Left on the front stoop of a police station as a toddler and then placed in an orphanage in Seoul, Korea, Toby was adopted at age 3 by two Vail ski instructors, Deb and Mike Dawson. They had him skiing by 4. He was beating them down the mountain by 9. In those days, he never thought about being the only Asian kid in powder white Vail. Never wondered who his blood parents might be. Never wanted to know, even though his brother, KC, who was also adopted, flew to Seoul 10 years ago and met his birth parents. Toby hated hearing about that meeting. Whether it was fear of the unknown or love of his adopted parents, Toby Dawson showed no curiosity about the subject, didn't ever go by his Korean middle name, Soo Chul, complained when his parents dragged him to Korean heritage camp, didn't want to be anything other than a blonde-haired, blue-eyed, regular American kid, he says. All I cared about was skiing. Problem was, Toby Awesome Dawson, as he's known, got too good, started winning World Cup events in the freestyle moguls. Pretty soon, the planet started noticing him, and people sure as hell noticed he wasn't blonde-haired and blue-eyed. I'm your father, Koreans emailed. I'm your mother. I'm your cousin. And Dawson's response was always the same. Get bent. I think he was blocking it out, says his mother, Deb, which was too bad because his dream was the Olympics. But mine was that the Olympics would be how he'd find his parents. Then something happened. Asked to return to that Korean heritage camp he so hated as a kid, he went and discovered something within himself. Suddenly, he wanted to know who he was. Quote, there was such a buzz with the kids there, he recalls. A lot of them had already found their birth parents. Some of the stories were amazing. Well, one of the stories he heard was my daughter's. We adopted Ray at 4 months, and she was the anti-Toby. She thought constantly about her birth mother, who had to be a princess or a movie star. So, when she was 11, we flew to Seoul, even though we were told that her birth mother would not meet with us. Unwed, she'd sneaked away at 16 to have the baby, and only her sister knew. She was married now with 3 kids, and she dared not be discovered. And yet, the interpreter told us, not a day went by that she didn't think of our Ray. Finally, she agreed to 30 stolen minutes in a coffee shop 2 hours from her home. We waited 3 hours. Ray looked heartsick. Finally, a cell phone rang. She said she'd meet us in the alley. And suddenly, there she was, tiny and white-faced. She climbed into our van. She looked at everybody but Ray. She said she had 10 minutes, that's it. I said to Ray, if you have any questions for your birth mother, ask them now. And Ray took out a folded piece of paper from her purse we didn't even know she had. Her first question, why did you give me up? Great shame, the woman told the interpreter, never looking at Ray. Question two, where's my father? Don't know, the woman said. Finally, a shocker. Question three, when you had me, did you get to hold me? The birth mother sort of hung her head, no. And that's when the interpreter said to her, well, you can now. Well, that broke her. That broke the birth mother. She wheeled on Ray and swallowed her up in her arms with kisses and sobs. I think the only people crying harder in that van were my wife and I. She would not let Ray go. Finally, she had to. She had to go. We haven't seen her since. Ray, though, was beaming. Quote, it feels like it fixed a little hole in my heart, she said. So when Toby Dawson shredded the Turin freestyle mogul course last month, beating his more ballyhooed teammate Jeremy Bloom and winning a stunning bronze medal, his picture ran in nearly every South Korean newspaper and on nearly every TV station. Somewhere, maybe his birth mother had read his story and seen him for the first time in more than 25 years, shouting, oh my God, that's my son! Only now, at last, Dawson is open to a meeting. He says, I think it'd be cool. I'd like to be friends. Well, he's got lots of possibilities. Since winning the medal, Dawson seems to have more long-lost parents than a Powerball winner. But so far, nobody's agreed to a blood test. I hope somebody does. I hope Dawson makes it over this one last mogul. Because an Olympic medal can fix a lot of things, but not little holes in the heart.
Rick Riley is senior writer for Sports Illustrated. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.